Welcome back to the Health Revival Show. I am so excited for today's interview. We have Dr. Turnpaugh, and he is actually the medical oversight for Restorative Wellness, now the Institute of Restorative Health. I'm still struggling to switch over. I graduated from there a few years ago as a Master Restorative Wellness practitioner, and I talk about them all the time and the education and the knowledge that they provide. And so we're excited to have you on the show today and talk all about the immune system. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, let's get into it, Tell us a little bit about, you know, where you're at, what you do, what you're up to. I know your practice is thriving and growing in new locations, all the things.
Well, thanks. So I'm in central PA in right outside of Harrisburg and Mechanicsburg. This will be 31 years in practice. And so I'm an oldie. And the practice kind of grew organically. We now have 5 locations, 22 providers, different locations, very collaborative. We have the whole gamut from health coaches, nurses, NPs, family nurse practitioners, MDs, DOs, acupuncture, psychology. So it's kind of, we have the whole gamut, chiropractic. And so have everybody kind of working collaboratively. We started where I started just really early on in my career when people were struggling, as all of us were. You know, you go back in time, 30 years, it wasn't really a built out profession. It's become more aware, but it wasn't very aware. So I was kind of that deep, dark secret in the medical community that just kind of, oh, you're weird, go see this guy type of a thing. So patients that just, and this is what we'll touch on today, that just aren't resolving. So we call it lack of resolution. They're stuck in a chronic, I don't feel good situation and looking for an answer. And where medicine thrives is, I jokingly say, strep throat, kill the strep, you're back to where you need to be. You know, you got a cold, you got over the cold, you're fine. It's when these things don't resolve that people are confused, or where they trigger the immune system or the brain. They're kind of, so the brain is more immunologic tissue than neural tissue. So if we reclassified it today, we'd call the brain immune tissue, not neural tissue. It's kind of funny, but it does both roles. And so when the immune system gets stuck in a loop, the brain can get stuck in a loop. So if somebody's been sick for a long period of time and there's not some kind of mental component, there's probably something wrong with that patient, right? If you haven't felt good for 30 years or 20 years or 15 years or 5 years, it weighs on you. So that plays a role on your brain. It plays a role on how you feel. It plays a role on your socialization, your environment, you know, your people. So kind of looking at both of those, and how do we get these back to a balance, or how do we get back to, as we said earlier, kind of a homeostasis or a healthy homeostasis, so you're not stuck in a pattern. Kind of the way you want to present your immune system and your brain to the world is balanced, where it can react and respond and resolve. And really what we see is, and I'm sure all of us do, is when patients don't resolve, right? If they resolve, they're not coming in our office. And if it's a simple thing that needs to resolve, they don't need to come to our office. They can get that anywhere, right? We're pretty good at that. As a simple thing, simple infection, simple resolution, that's not what they're coming to us for. They're coming to us because they're stuck. Or the other component is now, which has become more popular, is I want to stay healthy. How do I stay healthy? How do I, you know, that longevity piece that, you know, where we met, like, I want to live as healthy as I can for as long as I can. And we have a little thing, it's called livejevity instead of longevity. You want to live as much as you can. So there is some component of that, but most of our practice is still focused on chronic, I don't feel good, somebody help. Somebody listen to me. Somebody help me get out of this.
All right, if you're dealing with water retention, you're waking up puffy, your ankles or your wrists are really swollen, or you can't get your rings off, and maybe you're even dragging throughout the day, no matter how much water you drink, there's actually a good chance that you're not actually hydrating properly.
Exactly, because water alone is not enough. You need electrolytes, you need sodium, potassium, magnesium, because those things actually pull water into your cells. Otherwise, you're basically just flushing it out and wondering why you're still tired, you're still bloated, and you're still sluggish.
But here's the thing, most electrolyte supplements out there aren't helping you in any way, because a lot of them contain things like natural flavors, food dyes, and maltodextrin, which can irritate your gut, and these things can also spike your blood sugar when you're trying to heal.
That's why we both started using Buoy. It's super simple, just trace minerals and electrolytes in liquid form. No flavors, no colors, no sugar, no sweeteners, and you squeeze it into whatever you are drinking, water, coffee, tea, smoothies, you name it.
And it's clinically backed by science too. So studies have shown that Buoy helps you hydrate better, 64% better in fact, and that's data coming from key blood and urinary markers, not just marketing fluff. And honestly, you can feel the difference. I've had many clients tell me their digestion's improved, they have less headaches, and they're better energy throughout the day.
And Buoy isn't just for people that go to the gym all the time and sweat a bunch. They actually offer a 35% lifetime discount for anyone that's struggling with chronic illnesses. Things like POTS, Hashimoto's, Crohn's disease, chronic migraines, and every autoimmune condition. They're really committed to making better hydration accessible to people who need it most.
I actually throw it in my coffee every morning because it's such an easy upgrade. You don't even taste it, but you're definitely going to notice if you miss it.
If you're tired of playing hydration roulette and want something that actually supports your body, you've got to try Buoy. It's honestly one of the simplest ways to feel better faster.
So in these cases, I would love for you to kind of give insight of, okay, we have an infection that happened at some point. In a lot of them, that is the beginning. It might be accumulation of stress or other lifestyle factors that could also contribute. But in a lot of the cases, it's a COVID infection, a Lyme infection, EBV, whatever it might be. Can you talk a little bit around kind of physiologically what happens in these cases where maybe the infection was a problem at first, but then the immune system kind of becomes the main problem after the infection no longer is the problem, and why trying to constantly address the infection isn't necessarily the answer here?
Sure. So, well, start with, I'll use some terms. We have a pathogenic burden, right? A pathogenic burden, amount of bug in our system that our immune system is trying to fight. And that does need to resolve. You have to reduce the pathogenic burden. And the immune system tries really hard to do this. And it uses that side of the immune system, that Th1 side and those natural killer cell side to fight this. And most of the time, thank God, it resolves. So, you know, most of the time you get a cold, you get over it. You don't get sick forever. But as it goes on, that side of the immune system gets depleted and its counterweight, the Th2 side, becomes dominant. And that Th2 side is kind of that chronic stuck-in state. And not only are you now sending an abnormal message from the immune system and the brain, but also you, if it's a seesaw, the Th1 side gets depleted and the Th2 side gets dominant. And now you're stuck in this loop, which we can talk about, that Th2 dominant loop. You also now don't have a robust way to fight off these pathogenic burdens. So now you become more susceptible to everything. You get more susceptible to a cold, to a flu, to everything, because you don't have the ability to fight anymore with the natural killer cells and the Th1 side. And that Th2 dominant side is kind of a somewhat of a backup mechanism. But when you get stuck in that, that drives chronic inflammation, that drives microglial priming. So your brain may not think as well as it did before. You're kind of stuck in that sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, poor sleep, poor digestion. And it also drives that side that leads to autoimmune disease and cancer. So those are common denominator buckets. Kind of at the bottom is, if you stay sick long enough and an immune system shift long enough, you're increasing the probability to develop a named autoimmune disease before you have, you know, you'll get autoimmunity before we name it. And then you'll also more increase the probability to get cancer because you drive the pathway that is initiated during cancer. And really, we lose tolerance, right? You don't tolerate things. So you lose tolerance to infections, the first thing we talked about. So you're more susceptible to everything. You don't tolerate that. But you don't tolerate foods, and you don't tolerate smells, and you don't tolerate chemicals, and you don't tolerate EMF, and you don't tolerate your wife or your husband, and you don't tolerate your neighbor, and you don't so it's a carryover to, I don't have tolerance to my environment, and I don't even have the mental tolerance to deal with these things anymore. So they kind of go together, and you get stuck in this loop, this self-amplifying loop of stuck in that trench of TH2, and it affects your brain. You start to get that loop in your brain, and anything your brain keeps doing over and over again gets better at, right? So like anything you do, you develop this neuroplasticity in the brain, so it gets stronger and better at being in the state that it's in. And if that's not a healthy state, you get better at being in an unhealthy state. So it's a kind of a deconditioning and reconditioning. You want to break down those pathways in the brain, and you want to build up the side of the immune system that's deficient, all the while creating tolerance, right? Improving your tolerance. And we look to barriers. You know, we look to gut barrier, skin barrier, lung barrier. We look to barriers as our protection, and well, they break down as well. So, and this is the patient who even goes through functional medicine providers, and they've done the gut stuff, and they've done the challenging, which is a very challenging piece of brain. They've done the brain stuff, or they've done the gut stuff, but they really haven't balanced out that immune system. So they're kind of stuck in that chronic state of, I can't fight a bug, I can't tolerate things, I'm depleted. And, you know, this is where we look at, it'll start to affect not just relationships, but sleep and ability to exercise. And they can't recover from even their own tissues breaking down, like working out. So a workout is hard, or they don't recover for a week, or they work out and they feel sick because they worked out. So when we get a bug or a pathogen, we kind of break it up into little pieces, and we get these PAMPs, or pathogen associated molecular patterns. So you get like a bug, you break it up in little pieces. So that's a debris field of a bug. And we also have debris fields of our own tissue. So when we work out, we break our tissue down, it builds back up. And in the process, we break ourselves down a little bit. Those are also debris fields, or little minefields. And so when the body's constantly trying to resolve these debris fields of both pathogen tissue and self tissue, there's a lot of confusion there. And then you start to not just attack the bug, you attack yourself. And then it says, well, I'm going to attack everything. I'm not going to tolerate anything. I'm going to attack that smell. I'm going to attack that food. I'm going to attack my wife. I'm going to attack the dog. I'm going to attack, so you just don't tolerate anything. So I think there's tons of wisdom in reducing pathogenic burden, you know, keeping at a low level, healing the gut, you know, removing things that are big nasty in your life. But where is the restorative piece to immune shifts and immune balances? And I think that's what we're seeing. And that's fundamental. We start our conversation off with that chart, because we want patients to understand that, well, you're not weird, because we don't like that term. Oh, you're weird. You're unique, and you're not even that unique. If you understand the immune system and how it shifts, it becomes, how do we shift you back? And along the way, you're going to feel, it's going to mimic being sick. You're going to feel sick. So you think you're sick, and we're conditioned. If you're sick, very high level general pop, you're sick, take an antibiotic, it'll kill it. But that's not what's really going on. You don't have an army to even kill. So it's, can we get that side of that natural side of your own immune system to get back up to fight these things and balance it out, so you're not hyper-reactive to everything? Do you tolerate things better? And that does include a lot of the things we all talk about. It does include healthy borders and a healthy gut and a healthy diet and healthy sleep and all those pieces. But a lot of the things that we'll see is patients are either on this, you know, well, we don't want you to use antibiotics, but we want you to use natural killing agents. So they'll use natural cidal agents. It's still killing. It's not restoring the immune system. So how do we support that, dampen the response of that TH2 side and support that TH1 side? And ultimately, in the middle of the seesaw, I call mama bear, the regulatory cell, which says, I'm going to regulate how much ones and twos go out to fight. How do we support immune regulation? And what started off maybe as an infection, COVID, Lyme, EBV, anything, turns into, now I don't tolerate anything. Now my diet needs to get cleaner and my chemicals need to get cleaner. And it's important. So I say we want to remove the big nasties, the bugs, the very toxic foods. But I don't want you to live in a bubble where you only eat three or four foods and you can't be around any smells and you can't walk into an office because you're so sensitive. So how do you remove the big nasties and improve tolerance at the same time so that you can go live your life a more natural life. So
walk us through that a little bit. I mean, for the person listening right now, I'm sure this is resonating with them because we know in our practice, we see this a lot. There was a defining moment, and a lot of what we're seeing lately is I either had the injection and obviously spike proteins are crazy, crazy high, or I had a natural immunity and maybe still spike proteins are there. Or, for example, several conversations I've had this week is I'm seeing trends on their blood work, like low white blood cell counts, you know, higher low lymphocytes, neutrophils, basophils, eosinophils, all those types of things. But really, like when we're in the twos and the threes of a white blood cell count, it's like we know the immune system has been suppressed. This has been something that's ongoing in your body. And I'd love to hear your take on this because a large part of what our messaging is, we have to build you up before we can go into, even if there is a pathogen that we need to remove, I'm more concerned about building your body up so that you can tolerate even that eradication process if that's where we end up going. So what are your thoughts on that? Where would you start someone maybe in that scenario that you're also seeing? Yes, I see and know that there was a defining moment, but on the blood work, I am seeing that the body and the immune system is very low.
Yeah, well, it's the right approach, right? Because if you're seeing the white blood cells low, that's just pathognomonic. You can't fight anything. You don't have an army to fight anything. And, you know, when a normal response is you get sick, you would see an elevated white blood cell count. So if you see what I say is you've been in a fight for a long period of time, but your army is losing and you don't even have an army left. Look at your white blood cells. They're low. So what can we do to support even before we get to that T helper cells? Like, this is innate immune response. Like, this is just, you're not clearing debris fields. You can't. You can't clear out those minefields. What can you do to support even the innate immune system? So, you know, you can use things like sulforaphane or mushrooms are good at that, raising that white blood cell count. But getting them, and then once you start to mount a better immune response or be able to have an immune response, then you can add in some of the cidal agents that kill. But you really just killing without being able to clear. So, and then the soup becomes really muddy in a hurry because if you're not processing those things through, like through your liver and through your lymph, it becomes challenging. If you don't have a healthy microbiome to bind things, if you don't have binders naturally in your gut to clear these things out. So where does it become? We see extreme examples of this in medically. We'll see like hepatic encephalopathy, right? So the liver isn't clearing out the toxins and they lose their mind. They just actually lose their mind because that toxicity has to go somewhere. The body has to deal with that toxicity. In an extreme case, in a hospital case, when they have hepatic encephalopathy, the liver's not clearing out the toxins, the ammonia levels go up and they lose their mind, it's taking a toll on the rest of the tissue. So do we have healthy phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 detoxification? And you'd say, well, why is that important when we have a pathogen? Well, it's important because we got to clear it out of the body. We got to get it out of the body. You can't just recycle through, go into the gut, and then unconjugate, come back in through the gut wall, and now you're dealing with the metabolites of the problems. And I think everybody hits on some of this. So you'll see some practitioners that are really heavy on binders and removal of things, and some are on the liver and the gut, and some are on the kill protocol. But I really think putting all those pieces together synergistically, and it's not this is what you do and then this is what you do. It's what can the patient tolerate? Sometimes they have to crawl before they walk and walk before they run. So, and, you know, humbly, 31 years, still get it wrong sometimes. Whoops, we pushed on that lever a little too hard. But I'll say to a new patient that, you know, you've seen 12 other practitioners who are pretty smart. I'm probably also going to make a mistake. The difference I'd like to say is that when I make a mistake, I'll pivot quickly. I'll recognize the mistake and pivot quickly. We may be pushed on a little too much of that detox pathway, or we didn't build up the immune system enough before we started that cidal agent. So really working every case is an N of one, but putting those in place, we'll talk to a patient. We need to build up the immune system, build up the barriers, work on the liver detox, make sure it's getting out of your system at a rate your body will tolerate. So if they're coming in end stage wheelchair, really doing poorly, we're going to go very slow. If it's pretty recent, we can be more aggressive. And I, in the office with the 21 other practitioners, I'm the aggressive one. I'm like, you know, we're going to go after this hard, and I might make a mistake and have to back down, but we're going to push this to the envelope, because I don't want to be treating you in 5 years because we're taking baby steps when you could actually run. So really pushing that. But looking at the right things you're speaking of, like how do we get those white blood cells up? And those white blood cells low are almost always indicative of a Th1 insufficiency, as well as an innate immune system insufficiency. And so some of the easiest things like SPMs or fish oils, things that reduce inflammation, sulforaphane or broccoli seed extract are helpful, but can they even tolerate that in their gut? Is their gut so I'm speaking quickly, but your hollow cavities, like your lungs and your gut and your vaginal cavity, they're all Th2 dominant by nature. So you're already Th2 dominant in your hollow cavities. The hollow cavities are always Th2 dominant because what Th2 does really well is attack big things like pollen that you breathe in through your nose and allergies and asthma. That's Th2 dominance, and that's the correct response with the eosinophils kind of going after it. So you look at the eosinophils going up. So if we already have a state of a cavity that's Th2 dominant, and that's being exacerbated by an entire immune system that is dysfunctional and dysregulated to Th2 dominant, maybe they can't even handle what you're putting in their gut. So for example, we'll see patients where they've seen other practitioners and your gut's a mess. We're using high dose probiotics to try and balance this out. Even though they're symbiotic or healthy probiotics, they're still bugs. And you're having a hyper-responsive Th2. It doesn't matter. If you're not tolerating healthy food, you're probably not tolerating healthy bugs either. So how do we start to restore and dampen that down in the gut? One of the very underutilized products available to us is Perilla seed. Which is in the extinguisher, but Perilla dampens IL-4 and Th2. That's exactly what it does. Quercetin is very helpful for that too. So dampening the response and boosting the immune system at the rate limiting step is the patient, right? So how much can we increase Th1 and innate immune system and dampen Th2 and still keep them in a healthy balance is a way to work forward. And all of the things that we have learned with, you know, healthy gut and, you know, food intolerances, they all play a role. But I would simply say, I don't know it's the right way, but it's my way, is we have to look at the immune system regulation as the foundation before we even get into those things. Now, most of the time, for many of us, it's healthy enough that we can almost skip that step. And I think that's where people see success. Like, I did this and it worked. But what is really dangerous, been told to me a long time ago from a practitioner who works at North Carolina Medical School, is nothing is as dangerous as something that works 30% of the time. And I would say nothing is as dangerous as something that works 70% of the time, because really what you want to focus on is why doesn't it work the 30 or 70% of the time? And it's usually because we didn't address that underlying immunological imbalance. Now, these cytokines that drive these T helper cells, there's two major ways they come through the immune system peripherally, but the brain makes them as well. So if you're not addressing brain health or mood health, then that's going to drive that state of immune dysregulation from a emotional standpoint. So if you have a triggering or hyperactivation of the amygdala, if you have the brain not working as well, that brain is basically driving the immune system into dysregulation. So sometimes the brain just needs calm down. And things that will dampen brain activation. And that a lot of times we think of like adrenal overload or cortisol, but it's also you're like, if you don't have enough GABA and you have too much glutamate, so if you're driving these neurochemistry to a point of, and it's just constantly bathed in, oh my gosh, I'm in a fight mode, I'm in a sympathetic mode, and you know, the first thing that happens when we become sympathetic or fight or flight is we thin the mucosal lining of the gut wall and we make the gut very susceptible. So the first thing that happens when you're sympathetic is you shunt to run and you're in fight or flight. Well, the very first thing you'll see is you'll see the vagus nerve being activated to downregulate the immune system of the gut and the mucosal lining of the gut. And now when that happens and you're stuck there, I react to everything I eat. I drink water and I get bloated. All those things because it's just in this sensitive state. And if a patient comes in and says, I bloat all the time, my gut's a mess, I'm a train wreck. And we say, well, that's because you have leaky gut and you have dysbiosis. What if it's really a Th2 dominant shift from brain activation driving that? And so how do we get there to dampen that first? And the patient's sometimes like, what are you talking about my brain for? I came in because I'm bloated all the time. And we go, well, you have SIBO or you have CIFO or you have, like, maybe you do, but why do you have that? Like, why do you think your bugs translocated from your large intestine to your small intestine? Why is it moving in the wrong direction? Is it a GI motility issue? Is it? But a lot of times you'll deplete the mucosal lining, your secretory IgA, the immune system of your gut, and you can do all the things under the sun to focus on the gut when it's really a brain-based driven immune dysregulation problem. And the challenge too is when you do support the gut, they will get some improvement. Like, I feel pretty good. I feel a little bit better when I did that gut support thing you did. But boy, every time I get off, it just goes wonky. And so you're not getting to resolution. You're getting to just support. You're supporting them. So I think looking at what's driving this, we all talk about root cause and we get deeper, but sometimes these roots go really, really, really deep. And I would say that, again, most of these patients have an emotional component. They have this glial priming because they've been sick for so long. They're almost afraid to get better. They identify with their disease. And so, you know, I've spoken at many Lyme support groups. And when we talk about getting over it, they're like, oh, I can never get over it. They're kind of identifying, they're holding on to their sickness as they identify with that. You know, a question you can ask is, what does your life look like if you weren't sick? Well, they don't know. That puts them in a state of, oh my gosh, I can't even think about that. It's their identity. And so recognizing to almost all these patients, there's an emotional component. I'll say to even our clinicians, what are we doing to support their brain health as well as their pathogen load and gut health and liver detox and all those type of things?
Can you share a little bit about, I remember we discussed this, and it's been a couple of years, but how long it takes to see a response in terms of brain health. I remember you talked about you're going to compare seasons to seasons because it's not as quick to respond as, you know, let's say you take a motility agent. Okay, things start moving better. You take a digestive enzyme, bloating reduces. But really when we're looking at the brain health, we're thinking that this could take multiple months, maybe years to really kind of come back and restore some of that function. So share with us your thoughts there and then also how you address that, you know, with some of your patients in terms of maybe activities that you're having them doing. I don't know if you're doing like the Mendy or like neurofeedback things at home or if it's more supplement based or food based.
Yeah. So, it's a great point because if it's a pathogen, it's killing a bug, right? But if you have neuroplasticity, I just simply describe, I'm sure most of your listeners know what it is, but you're turning a dirt road into a six-lane highway, right? So when you do things over and over again in the brain, it becomes stronger and you turn that dirt road into a six or eight-lane highway. That doesn't mean it's the right highway. It may be the wrong pathway you're building up. And then how long does it take for that six-lane highway to break back down into a dirt road? And we have certain pathways, canalized pathways that are always present, but the rest of them we adapt to and build. So I like to give patients the exact metaphor you said. We don't compare weeks to weeks. We compare seasons to seasons. And it's also important when we talk about psychiatric things and we're counseling patients and working with them, to get them like off psych meds. We don't make changes in the fall or the winter, because it's the time when you're typically not doing well. Emotions darker, it's colder, it's all that kind of stuff. So If I see a patient and they're a new patient in February, they're probably going to do a little bit better with me doing nothing because March, April, and May are coming. See a new patient in August, they're probably not going to do as well because they're heading into September, October, November. So when they say, I was doing so much better in August, I'm like, no, we're comparing this August to next August. We're comparing seasons to seasons. How well did you do last summer compared to this summer? It also gives the patients permission to take time to get better. So they don't feel like they're the failure. You know, sometimes they'll project to the provider, but a lot of times, like, I'm failing. You're not failing. We haven't even given it enough time. You know, it's easier with a female menstruating patient when we're comparing how their cycles are doing. Like, we're not going to check it in 2 weeks because you haven't had a cycle yet. So you got to give me some time to see how that cycle's doing. So they'll get like, okay, yeah, I get it. So we're comparing seasons to seasons and we're breaking down a 6-lane highway back to a dirt road. And by the way, every time you drive along that 6-lane highway, it gets stronger. So it's not like today we're just blocking that 6-lane highway and it's going to magically degrade to the dirt road, because that is the default pathway. So that default pathway has to change, and it doesn't change magically. Like, we just didn't shut off the road so it can degrade over time. We reduce the load on that road, so it's still firing, but not as frequently, not as plastic, not as much building. So changing them out of that groove emotionally back to a normal state of calmness or more parasympathetic at times, it takes time, and giving the patients permission to have that time. There's certain things we do want to see change. You know, again, simple things. Your vitamin D is low. We expect that to change on the next lab. But this plastic change you have in your brain, give yourself some grace. Give yourself some time. Allow that to break down. Let's compare seasons to seasons. And that might take years. And not years without change, but years until we get back to a different state. You know, we do use a phrase, consistency looks like nothing is changing until one day it does, right? So, you know, being consistent and staying the course, giving yourself time to see that I was doing this forever and nothing is changing. Well, that's consistency. Consistency looks like nothing is changing until one day it does, right? And so, and they also have, because they've suffered for so long, they suffer from short-term memory. So when how you doing? I'm no better. I'm like, well, let's talk about how you were doing 3 months ago. Before you couldn't get out of bed and get showered by yourself, and now it's a struggle to go to the grocery store. Well, that's an improvement. So I use the phrase too, you're directionally correct, but far from complete. Directionally correct, but incomplete is not failure. It's directionally correct. We're going to stay the course. And doing better isn't the enemy of doing perfect, right? So better is still important. So giving them setting the stage. So there's nothing worse than setting the stage of, and I think we've all gone through it. Like, I am the greatest clinician that ever walked the face of the earth, and I am going to fix you and you will be better in 3 months. You're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
We're doing this for a long period of time. Like, listen, I'm the guy that's also going to make a mistake. I'm going to pivot. But this is going to be not a straight line out of this. It's going to be a bumpy road. Because you're setting it, well, you told me I was going to be better in 3 months, or we set the expectation that you're going to be better in 3 months or 2 months or next week. And that's not fair to the patient. It's not fair to the clinician either. It's okay to be vulnerable.
So I think we should just say, for practitioners listening to this, stop giving your patients timelines. Becca and I, in our practice, we have a 6-month program. And again, just had this conversation this week. I can't make promises. No one can. That would be it would be a disservice to do that. So I'm always talking on my Instagram about, like, practitioners, stop doing these things, because you give people false hope and it gives functional medicine a bad name. And really, no one except for our creator can know how long it's going to take for us to heal. And by the way, your adherence to the process matters too. So sorry,
resonate with that so much. And also, hey, you saw my neighbor who had this condition and you help them, so you're going to help me. I'm like, whoa. Like, no two people walk in the same. So we've had some moderate success with, like, multiple sclerosis, and people come in like, you help multiple sclerosis. I'm like, whoa. Different. you're going to be on your own journey. Your timeline's going to be different. Don't even know if I'm going to be successful. We're just going to work at this. So helping, again, helping the previous patient doesn't mean the next patient is going to respond the same way. They're going to have their own unique immunological imbalances and brain imbalances and challenges and uniqueness to them. And no two people are the same. So kind of we get that fault. Well, I hit a home run on the last one that I saw like this. Yeah, that was the last one. Just forget about that and start from scratch on this one again. Yeah.
It's funny because a lot of people reach out to us and are like, where'd you get your education? How do you know all this stuff? And I'm like, seeing hundreds upon thousands of cases at this point and messing up a lot. And then you just learn and you think that it was the right thing to do and it wasn't, and it's going to happen again. But the more you do it, the more you start to learn. And I was like, no certification, although there's great ones out there. I haven't done RWS, but I actually refer a lot of people to you guys because it is such a good program. But I'm like, no certification alone is going to give you the answers to every person. Like, it is experience. And even then, it's constant learning, and people teach you every time they're in front of you. And it's part of what I think makes good practitioners good practitioners is knowing, like, I don't know everything. I'm never going to know everything.
I have used the phrase many times. People bring you unique stuff all the time. I had a patient yesterday, and she said, I sit around the dinner table and say, my doctor goes home and learns. Like, doesn't he know enough? He's been doing it for 30 years, but he goes home and learns. But I used the phrase to some of my clinicians, and it was kind of harsh. I said, I know a thing or two because I've seen a thing or two, and there's a whole lot more that I don't know that I do know. But it's really challenging. If you haven't seen a thing or two, it's hard to know a thing or two. So some of it comes by, I've had very blessed, fortunate experience. So I walk down the hallway, someone's like, I've never seen that before. I'm like, that's copper toxicity. And they said, how on earth would you know that? I said, because 13 years ago I saw it. Like, it's just because you know a thing or two because you've seen a thing or two. And also, there's a phrase that I use. I actually used it when at the lecture I did there. It's by Mark Twain. It ain't what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for certain that just ain't so. And we have so much of that in the medical field. I know, and I think I know, but maybe I don't. And learning all the time and be a learn-it-all rather than a know-it-all is really the key to being a good clinician and having a patient expectation that I say frequently, they'll bring me in something unique that I haven't seen before. And, you know, after 30 years, it's less and less, but it's still a ton out there. And I'll say to them humbly, I don't know anything about that, but I will tonight. I will. I'll go home and study. Like, I will. And having an advocate for the patient to say, he didn't know about that, but he's not an idiot. He's pretty well versed in this field. He's going to learn about it. Is not like, yep, I know about that, lying to them and giving that false sense of, I have it all figured out. I'm all things to all people. I'm not. You bring me something unique. And I've been caught in this in the right way. They're like, hey, what do you know about this? And I said, I've never heard of that before. And they'll say, well, good, because there's only 13 of these in the world. So if you heard about it, I knew you were lying to me. So just being forthright, like, I don't know anything about it. I'll learn about it, but I don't know anything about it. And they're like, well, I'm glad you said that, because if you did, I knew you were lying to me, because nobody knows much about this.
So I always say, be careful of people that are dogmatic, because they typically aren't going to be the ones that are going to, you know, search for a different answer when they don't have it. They're going to tell you that you're the problem, and just, you know,
everything is lime, everything is mold, everything is food, everything. That's because you're a hammer, so everything is a nail. There are times it is, and that's like, well, it must be right because I get 40% of my patients better all the time. And I'd say that's a failure rate, is 60% failure rate. So the ones that are what you think it is, if it is a nail, the hammer works great. But if it's not a nail, you know, and then they just say, well, you're weird. You're unique. Oh, you're not following the program. Like, no, maybe I'm nuanced. Maybe, yeah. And we see, in functional medicine, we see the unicorns, right? We don't see if they got better with regular allopathic treatment, they wouldn't be coming to us.
Mm-hmm. It's always, and it's kind of, I don't want to say it's fun, but it's like you're a little detective, and it's really, you know, figuring out these cases, because no one case is the same. Their health history is always different. And it's being humbled enough to be able to know, like, you're going to constantly be learning, and you're going to constantly be feeling like, you're an idiot sometimes and you don't know things, but then you're going to figure it out, because that's what you're fighting for, you know?
have a brilliant friend, Sam, and he says every case is an experiment. Every case is a trial and error. But it's really how astute are you to pick up on the nuance of that was a trial, but it was an error. Let's pivot, right? Let's pivot. And they say, don't panic, but pivot. But if you don't have that nuance, like I tried that, it didn't work. Let's quickly change instead of saying, nope, it's this always works. And so just every patient is a trial. Every patient is a unique case and trying different things. Now there's core. I mean, there's obviously core things that we all do that, but I think a lot of people have that down. And again, I think RWS does a really good job of building the platform of the scaffolding of where to start. And then it just becomes nuanced after that.
Yeah. So
much more to learn. I feel always. Because I think similar, the reason I resonated with you so much when you came and talked about this immune cell differentiation, you know, chart is because we truly believe that the immune system is the root cause and that you can't really resolve a lot of these issues for people. Like you mentioned, and we talked offline, but I know that you've told the story several times, the patient that came in with 24 years of antibiotics, once another year of antibiotics, and it's like, you're just chasing what now would be maybe like a ghost infection. There's no infection there. You've killed it off. If you haven't killed it in 24 years, like you say, you're not killing it now. So could you touch on that for those individuals who, because we have a lot of listeners, they've done a lot of the work and we get these people in our practice. They're taking 39 different supplements. You know, they're still struggling. And I'm saying you've missed the forest through the trees because you got to go back to the drawing board. We have to go back to the foundations and create the safety. And killing isn't always the answer, or more killing isn't always the answer.
Yeah, I'll tell a unique story. I wouldn't believe it if it didn't happen to me. I had a patient who had Lyme disease, got bit on the actual deltoid, got a bullseye rash, got better. Every time they ate gluten, the bullseye rash came back. Like, you couldn't make it up. So every time they ate gluten, they went back to their practitioner and got back on an antibiotic. Well, we know antibiotics don't kill gluten, right? So we had an immune memory. The memory cells were still in there. And when the immune system got agitated or irritated, it defaulted back to its sick presentation, which was the bullseye rash and the symptoms of Lyme. And so they're like, you know, I always get these antibiotics whenever I get this bullseye rash back. And I'm like, well, I think we're missing the forest and the trees, or the trees in the forest, or however the phrase goes. And so whatever it is. And I said, listen, you have lost tolerance. You have a hypersensitive Th2 memory B cell response that has never been downregulated. So we're going to shift on building up your innate immune system and your Th1 side, making sure you have plenty of, very simply, like glutathione and vitamin D and sleep and love and appreciation. And, you know, one of the tiny little lectures I do is when you care about a patient and just say, I care about you, I'm on this journey together with you, you change that T cell polarization. You change the T cell differentiation. And many times you go in, the doc doesn't even talk to you. They're looking at the computer screen. Okay, I'm going to give you this medication. You altered their immune system. They used to tell, specifically they did a study in AIDS patients, female AIDS patients, when they told them they had AIDS, their CD4 counts dropped by 40% just with the knowledge. So the fact that we think that you're not affecting someone's immune, it's not psychobabble fun stuff, it's actually changing the immune system and caring for the patient, goes a long way just in immune health. Knowing they have a healthcare provider that's on the journey with them, sometimes that does as much on the immune system and the immune cell differentiation as anything else, just having a compassionate person on the other side. So focusing on building up the white cells, again, you can use let's start with the easy thing is removing the offending agent, right? So again, if you live in a moldy house, there's no, one of the practitioners, what do I do? Somebody lives in a moldy house. I said, what bar of soap is going to wash somebody if they wash in a cesspool? There's no soap big enough to clean them if they're in the cesspool. So removing for a period of time the offending agent, and that could be the pathogen, that could be the exposure, that can be whatever. So removing the offending agent is going to be core, right, if possible. Now, not everybody can do that, so we have to do workarounds because financially they can't leave their apartment or whatever. but really kind of identifying what the trigger, if the ongoing trigger is still there, and trying to resolve that ongoing trigger. And then looking at the inflammatory cascade, what are we doing to modify the inflammation? Inflammation short term is great. And what we say is it's not the inflammation that's bad, it's the lack of resolution of the inflammation that's bad. So why are you not resolving the inflammation? Do you not have, they're actually called resolvins. Do you not have enough resolvins? And they can come from things like fish oils and different things. Do you have, over time, I think a huge piece that may be missed is mitochondrial health. So the mitochondria take a huge hit. They're exhausted, right? So if you're in a sympathetic state and you're activating your brain all the time, that's just burning your engines, and your engines are the mitochondria. So what are we doing for mitochondrial support? What are we using to support that? Are we giving your body enough fuel even to mount a response? I know, like, it's been all over recently, but creatine is just giving your body raw fuel. So are you giving enough creatine to fuel the muscles and fuel the brain? Do we need to look at things like urolithin A and alpha-ketoglutarate, CoQ10, PQQ, and GG? Are we looking for things that are just, you know, they come in and they say, listen, I'm bloated all the time. Like, well, all right, well, we're going to focus on tolerance and mitochondrial health. Like, what are you talking about? Like, well, it takes a lot of energy to do what you're doing, and you don't even have any energy. So kind of looking at it from a different lens of, well, the immune system can't get out of inflammation if the mitochondria aren't healthy, if it doesn't have a healthy cell wall. So it's really hard to clear out debris fields if your liver isn't working correctly. It's really hard to change the T cell polarization if your mind is stuck in an anxious state. So I like for people that are stuck in an anxious state and their DHEA may be high or their cortisol levels may be high, I like Hanokule. I like the DHHB Hanokule. It's a double-stranded Hanokule. But that actually calms down that response. Can you use things like GABA or L-theanine? There's different things. So looking at, you came here for this reason, but I want to get an inventory of your overall immune and brain health as far as a state, and how is that being affected? So, and you can do things like, we have IASIS here, but you can do biofeedback, you can do meditation, you can do prayers, calming, you need something that's calming. How much activity can you handle? Not to get too deep into the weeds, but can you do zone 2 and zone 5 training? Like, can you tie in that? How long does it take you to recover from that? So can you do intense training? Can you not? How long does it take you to recover? And rather than just saying, well, we're going to slow that down, that tells me that the mitochondria aren't working well. So can we support mitochondrial health as well? Are you constantly abusing the system by eating foods that are triggering to you? So can we remove that? Can we dampen that immune response from foods? Again, like things like perilla are great. If you just don't know, you can simply say, well, perilla is going to work for a TH2 dampening, which is most of these cases. So if you said, what is a chronic case? And I had to put it, I don't like protocols. That's a 4-letter word to me. But if somebody says they're chronically ill for 5 years, what do you think is going on? And that's all you gave me? They're TH2, TH17 dominant, with abnormal cytokine, and they have lack of proper antigen presentation to that immune system. So what could you do with that? Well, you can have them rest, not overdo it, make sure they're getting proper sleep, change food antigen presentation, make sure there's not a bug and mold, and you can drive TH2 down. Well, how would I do that? I would make sure they had plenty of glutathione, healthy levels of vitamin D, and I would use perilla and quercetin, resveratrol, you know, turmeric. So you're at least you're, and if you just start there, that's going to give you some traction to say, okay, I've dampened some of this. Where can I go next? What can the body tolerate? And again, we talked about before, like, well, your gut's a mess, let's give you probiotics. I can't tell you the amount of times we do that, and it backfires because they can't handle the bug. Even if it's a good bug, they can't handle the bug. They can't handle because the gut is still saying, listen, I'm angry. I'm already primed. You gave me something foreign in here as a bug, I'm going to react to it. Even if it's what they may need in 3 or 6 months, they may not need it in the first 3 or 6 days or 3 or 6 weeks.
So good. We could talk all day, I'm sure.
Yes, this is amazing. So can you in terms of TH1 dominance, TH2 dominance, can you give just like a brief, this is what this commonly looks like in terms of symptomology or, you know, for both the, because sometimes we see the opposite, right? Sometimes we do see TH1 versus TH2 or vice versa.
Yeah, so TH1 has, if you're TH1 dominant, you're probably not going to stay there because that's the side that will deplete. So, but you can do that. You can be in a TH1 dominant state for a while. And even if you go into the literature and look at things like TH1 dominant autoimmunity, really there's two reasons for that. One is it's an adaptive change to TH2. And early on, I don't want to get in the weeds here, but in 2006, they discovered that the TH1 looks, half of it looks identical to TH17. So prior to 2006, there was no TH17. We hadn't identified it yet because there's two legs of it. One leg is the same. So even TH17, they called TH1. So if you read literature that's referencing anything prior to 2006 and read about TH1 dominance, it's most likely not. It's falsely labeled as a TH17 dominant autoimmune condition. So they'll be in that state for a while, and that's if they're hypervigilant. They kind of overreact to they get sick, but they overreact to it. They just that can happen. It's rare, but it can happen. TH2 dominant size. So TH2 is also when you're TH2 dominant, you'll have mast cell degranulation. You'll have histamine response. So again, we label these things all that you can. Say my gut's inflamed, so I got SIBO. You can say I have mast cell activation. You know, I have histamine dominance. You're just telling me you're TH2 dominant. You're just telling me it's the manifestation of TH2 dominant. So you cannot have mast cell activation and histamine intolerance without being TH2 dominant. So again, it's, you have it, but it's layered on top of the immune system. And so the immune system being skewed is what is driving the name of the disease, whether we call it mast cell activation or long COVID or, you know, the cytokine storm that became popular. Well, a lot of us have been talking about that prior to COVID. It's a cytokine storm is really, cytokines are just ways that immune cells and other cells talk to each other. And if you're dominant on a TH2 side, you have a cytokine reactivation of a self-amplifying loop because you're giving off too many cytokines. And so, you know, at the core of inflammation is NF-kappa-B and IL-1 beta. So if things that dampen NF-kappa-B give you some time to figure out the rest of it. So again, that's where you got like your turmeric, your resveratrol, boswellia, fish oils, things that are supporting the inflammatory pathway. That gives you time to catch your breath and see what else is going on.
Last question for me, and then I'll stop because I know we got to be respectful of time. Perimenopause and menopause seems to be triggering for a lot of women, histamine issues, you know, heart palpitations, headaches, food intolerances. And, you know, obviously with estrogen dropping, you lose like some mucosal barrier protection, and with fluctuations of estrogen, you kind of stimulate the immune system in different ways. Is there other things that you see in this kind of time, or are people just more aware, or... So I feel like it's kind of been a large buzz/influx lately in that time of life.
It is. So I'll go back to like years ago when perimenopause wasn't as popular, but it should have been, because I think I agree with all the popular people. The largest disservice in healthcare is women in perimenopause and postmenopause. That's bar none. Like that's the worst thing medicine's ever done is take... If it was a male problem, we'd have dealt with it 40 years ago, but it's a female problem, so we kicked it to the curb. So it's a disservice. But, you know, to summarize in ways that are not popular but hit home, when the ovaries retire and they go on vacation, then the adrenal gland picks up the slack, right? So the adrenal gland's part-time job is to support hormones, but when the ovaries retire, it becomes its full-time job, right? So if you look back and say, what was the adrenal gland taxed prior to perimenopause? Super important. So the time to go and cruise through perimenopause is years prior to affect that stress response, which is everything we've just talked about, right? All the things we've talked about is, are, can you get yourself in a healthy state so that you can handle the stressors of perimenopause? And then when you have the rapid drop in progesterone, and progesterone is very GABAergic, right? So progesterone helps females sleep. It calms them down. It does. It's actually an FDA approved sleep aid. So so when you lose that, you kind of lose that parasympathetic support, right? And then you have the androgen receptors at the cell level, and they're waking up and turning off and waking up and turning off because they're getting these spikes and fluctuations of estrogen. And then you're turning on the alpha receptor versus the beta receptor of the estrogen receptor, and they become more inflammatory. This is, you're dumping a whole lot of hormone at different levels, triggering a cell response. And the question is, how well are you able to handle that? Because there's a whole piece that I think we should support perimenopause and postmenopause. I do. The reason some females will say, I went through, I had three hot flashes, I was fine. Other people, you know, were switching from running out in the snow because their body's burning and they can't sleep and do anything. And, you know, that's the largest rate of divorce is because they're going. So it has massive mood changes. Well, those people, you can't go back in time, but if you could, you'd say, can we support the adrenal medulla? Can we support brain and that sympathetic hippocampal escape? So what kind of stresses were you under? What was your level of stress prior to this? And people think it's woo-woo, but we have post-traumatic menopause. People have a traumatic issue, so we know that it happens. It just throws them into immediate menopause. So I think looking back and supporting not just hormones, but supporting the whole stress physiology leading up to that. And then these hormones have to go through the liver, and they break down. I say, you know, your estrogen breaks down into the three components, the 2, 4, and 16 metabolites. They go through the liver, but then they have to kind of be captured from a healthy microbiome and eliminated. If they're not, they're released. They unconjugate. They come back into the system, and they wreak havoc with the androgen receptors, because those metabolites then trigger those receptors, and you get all these symptoms. So it's not just simply give them estrogen, give them progesterone, maybe a little testosterone, and send them on their way. Why were they crashing so bad? Because they had a lot of stress. Their adrenal glands probably weren't ready to take on this full-time job. And then their brain, even though they can handle it before, has had these plastic changes. So these dirt roads have turned into six-lane highways that now are becoming very apparent. So again, it's that holistic support of, yes, they may need hormones. They may absolutely need support, and not or, and they also need these other pathways supported. And you can predict, not 100%, but you can predict who's probably going to have a miserable perimenopausal experience if you took a good inventory of the antecedents prior to going into perimenopause.
So manage your stress is what you're saying. That's what I'm hearing.
Yes. I mean, and again, if you're having, like you said, you're having this histamine response, well, were your TH2 primed going into perimenopause? So manage your stress, balance your immune system, tolerate more things, because it's really hard to tolerate a lot of things when you're in the throes of perimenopause. So it's a challenge. And so what's your ability to tolerate? What's your tolerogenicity? How much can you tolerate before we put you in a stressful situation? If that's low, let's try and fix that before we get into that stressful state.
So good. Well, I know that we are out of time because to get going here, but thank you so much for joining us. I know I'll email, I think it's your wife, but your team, and see if we can get something on the calendar for 2026 with our team, because you're just a wealth of knowledge. And so thank you again so much. And with that, will you just let our listeners know where they can go to learn more about you, your practice, and website, all those things?
Sure. Yeah. My team would kill me if I didn't. So it's Turnpaw Health. We have Instagram, Facebook. And starting next year, we just built a new clinic, another clinic, and I want to put out more educational information. So it's all going to be free. It's not going to be monetized, just by sharing the information. So we're on Instagram at Turnpo Health. Website is Turnpo Health. And I think we're on Facebook too. And honestly, I'm totally ignorant. I don't do any of that. So,
hey, you know what? It's less stress for you. That's actually a good thing. So amazing. Well, thank you. Yes, we heard that you were going to be doing some more things in 2026. And that's what I'm excited to maybe chat with your team about in terms of some of that education and mentorship too. So,
yeah, I've loved it. I do want to leave with the takeaway. I know I didn't give a lot of hardcore, what do I do? Because it's different for everybody. But I think if we give the platform to either patients or practitioners, is look at the immune system and see if your care, you know, if they're coming in on 32 supplements, what are those supplements? Why are you taking them on? What effect does that have on the immune system polarization or the immune system cell differentiation? Use that as your springboard to, what am I doing, and looking at the underlying pieces. So I'm grateful that you brought it up, because I think this is a huge missing piece across our profession.
It is, very much so. And it's, I think it's sad. It's exciting, right, for the future, but it's also sad to see so many people that have suffered for so long. I just have, I know Becca talks with these people too, and I'm sure you do as well, but a couple people just this week, you know, they've spent 5-6 years in functional medicine, but they're chasing the wrong things. And so that's, you know, your body can't heal if it doesn't feel safe. Or like you've mentioned before, it can't, I always say it can't heal in the environment that's making it sick. You said it perfectly with soap, right? And so it's just one of those things, we're really coming back to some of those foundational pieces, because I truly believe God designed us to heal. We just have to be able to create that safety and the environment for us to do so.